Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Money Talking from WNYC. I'm Charlie Herman. I'm joined by our regular contributors, Joan Osaer with The New York Times and Rana Fruhar with Time Magazine. General Motors says it's connected 13 deaths and dozens of accidents to a defective ignition switch. And despite reports going back a decade about this problem, the company is only now recalling more than 2.5 million Chevy Cobalt and other cars that may have this switch. For Mary Barra, it has been a real test of fire. She only became the CEO in mid-January of this year, and 3 months into the job, she's facing accusations from members of Congress that GM has a culture of cover-up and could face criminal liability. Barra has apologized. She's launched internal investigations. She's even hired the go-to guy for victims' compensation funds, Ken Feinberg. He's the same person who handled similar funds for victims of 9/11 and the BP oil spill. So, Joe, Rana, give me a grade. How would you say she's handling this crisis?
You know, I think in terms of her personal handling of it, I'd have to give her an A. You know, that's not to say that GM may not have done some things that were very, very wrong. And, you know, the culture, not so much of secrecy, but of bean counting over design and engineering, has been written about a lot. There was actually a wonderful book that was done by the former vice chair of GM, a guy named Bob Lutz, called Car Guys versus Bean Counters, that recounted some of the crazy stories of bad decisions made based on cost cutting. This ignition switch problem, of course, takes that to a new level, and people's hair really stands on end when you think about, wow, they made a decision to save 90 cents on a switch, which may have cost people's lives. But I think that given all that, she's doing a very good job of being totally transparent, pulling out all the big stops, already starting to talk about compensation for victims, telling people what she's doing at every stage. So in terms of crisis management, I got to give her an A.
Well, I'm not going to be quite that kind. I would give her basically a B minus. I think she's tried really hard to make distinctions between the old GM, pre-bankruptcy GM, and the new GM, cutting out layers of bureaucracy and talking about trying to get to the bottom of it. But the bottom line is she's been forced to go to Congress and basically say, I'm apologizing, but I don't really know what happened. And again and again and again, she came across, even if she wasn't trying to stonewall, even if she doesn't know all the answers, she came across as somebody who was, in fact, stonewalling.
Well, are there lessons here when you see the way, Joe, that she's trying to respond? Are there lessons here for other CEOs? Or is it just when you face Congress and they're asking you these tough questions in the middle of an investigation, you don't really have the answers?
It is difficult to face Congress in this situation. Part of the reason is because you know that there are all these lawyers circling around you waiting for you to say one wrong word. On the other hand, it would have been helpful if she had had a little more information and knew a little more about what has happened. I mean, I know there's an investigation ongoing and she doesn't want to get in the middle of it, but you would think that she would have some answers that she could give Congress so she would feel less like a stonewall.
Like the fact that she just said, I don't know, when she didn't know. I mean, it's such a refreshing thing sometimes to hear a CEO admit that, and I think it's a very different way of communicating. I was actually kind of disappointed, again, not to excuse anything, any wrongdoing at GM, but I was kind of disappointed in how much political grandstanding there was during the testimony. And, I mean, Barbara Boxer coming out and saying, I'm disappointed in you, Mary Barra, as a woman. I mean, come on. You know, it's like, she's trying to do the best she can. Let's not feel we need to hold her to some higher standard because she's a female leader.
I want to move on to another highly charged discussion that's been happening, and this one here in New York City, or focused in New York City. It has to do with high-frequency trading. This is the computerized trading that happens in nanoseconds, and it really all started after Michael Lewis, the author, sat down for an interview with 60 Minutes on Sunday to talk about his new book, Flash Boys, which is about high-frequency trading, and basically said the stock market is rigged. From that point, there's been a huge debate. There have been more news stories, riveting and even slightly crazed debates on television about whether the stock market is rigged. So, Joe, Rana, is it?
I think it is. I think Flash Boys is pretty convincing, but it's not the only piece of evidence. There's lots of evidence that high-frequency traders are able to get in front of trades of other investors and trade ahead of them. They have a variety of techniques and devices that require speed, speed, speed. And if they can get there faster, they can trade ahead of you, and it's not right.
I agree. I think the market is totally rigged in this sense. And this is just the most egregious example, but it kind of raises a conversation, I hope, about short-term trading versus long-term holding in general. I mean, I hope that people kind of go beyond this sexy story, which is great, and start talking about tax policy. I mean, I don't think that gains on super short-term trades should be taxed in the same way that longer-term holdings are. I think we really need to think about policy solutions to all this.
Well, let me ask, if you're just a general investor, say you have money in a 401k or you have money in an IRA and you're holding on to it for the long term, is this whole debate about high-speed trading, does it really involve you?
It does affect the little guy in the sense that these large institutions are able to use their superior technology and speed to get out in front of individuals, not just individual traders, but even smaller institutions. It really isn't an equal playing field.
It does one other thing. It robs people of confidence in the market.
Right.
And if investors lose confidence in the market, there won't be a market.
That's a great point.
Well, let's look ahead to some of the other stories we're watching. Rana, what's on your radar?
Well, I've been looking at a new study by a couple of economists at the Harvard Business School that looks at growth in the finance sector. And one thing that really jumped out at me is the fact that New York is actually kind of lagging as a financial center these days. It is, of course, the biggest financial center still in the U.S., but because Wall Street is no longer driving growth in the industry, but rather mutual fund companies are and other types of companies that manage individuals' assets, it means that cities like Boston and certain cities on the West Coast are actually doing better relative to New York now in terms of the financial industry. And I think it's going to be interesting to see what that means for the economies of all those cities.
Joe, what are you watching?
I'm looking forward to Sunday night when we get the first episode on HBO.
Of Game of Thrones?
No, Silicon Valley. It's a new series from Mike Judge, the man who gave us such classics as Office Space and Beavis and Butthead. Now, I like The Social Network a lot, but it didn't really quite capture the essence of Silicon Valley, the awkwardness, the greed, the lemming-like behavior of venture capitalists.
Basically, so, Game of Thrones.
I guess so. So I'm looking forward to seeing if Mike Judge gets it right.
We'll be watching those stories and all the week's financial news at WNYC.org. You can also take this program with you as a podcast, available on iTunes. Rana Faruhar with Time Magazine and Joe Nocera with The New York Times, thanks so much for joining.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Charlie Herman. This is Money Talking from WNYC.